Martin Luther King Jr. spent quite a bit of time in Miami and even practiced his famous speech right here in South Florida. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. For this Martin Luther King Day, we wanted to look back at the time Dr. King spent in Miami. He did a lot of important work to build a stronger relationship between African Americans and the Cuban community. We'll hear some fascinating stories about why Dr. King enjoyed spending time in the Magic City. Also, there are a lot of characters who come together to create the scenes of a rodeo. The Sundial team recently went to the 70th anniversary of the Homestead Rodeo. And finally, it was more than 40 years ago when the groundbreaking show Que Pasa USA aired. There's a new show that pays homage to that sitcom. It's called Hialeah, filmed in Hialeah, and it's available only on Facebook. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez on this Martin Luther King Jr. Day.
I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal. Yeah.
Nearly 60 years ago, he delivered his iconic I Have a Dream speech in Washington, D.C. But well before Dr. King delivered that speech, he practiced it and crafted it here in Miami at the historic Hampton House. The Miami Hotel in the city's Brownsville neighborhood had visitors like Muhammad Ali, Jim Brown, and some of the era's most iconic African-American civil rights leaders during Miami's segregated era. We spoke with Dr. Enid Pinckney, the president and CEO of the Hampton House, about Dr. King's legacy in Miami and his involvement in the desegregation movement.
To assemble, because it was just gorgeous. It was beautiful. It was elegant. It had class. And people wanted to be in that setting. They loved it. Dr. Martin Luther King had a favorite room there, so did Muhammad Ali. Malcolm X was there. Nancy Wilson. All of the celebrities that came to Miami, they could not stay in a white hotel. So they wanted to feel comfortable, and they wanted to feel safe, and they wanted to feel good. So the Hampton House provided that for them, and they just loved it. The Hampton House had a swimming pool, and it had good food, and it was just a place where people loved to be.
And you talk about it, you say it was beautiful. How would you describe, because you know, when I look at photos, I see a lot of black and white photos, but how would you describe, what was that ambiance like? What did it look like?
Well, for instance, the cafe, the paintings on the wall, the wallpaper, the colors, the color scheme was beautiful. The lobby with the gold desk, and it was just a place that you just felt good being there.
Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. started coming down to South Florida in the 1950s. It's interesting to note that much of his trips down here were done in secret, in part for his protection. Who were some of his confidants here in Miami, the people that were closest to him?
Well, Dr. John O. Brown, A.D. Moore, was an officer in CORE organization, the Congress for Racial Equality, CORE.
Okay.
And A.D. Moore, Talmadge Fair, some of the leaders who in the community at that time, most of them are dead now. Dr. Brown's dead. A.D. Moore is dead. And they were a part of CORE. And the Markowitz, which was a Jewish couple that owned the Hampton House, permitted Carr to have regular meetings there at the Hampton House. And so Dr. Martin Luther King came to some of those meetings.
Talk to us a little bit about CORE, as you said, the Congress of Racial Equality.
What they did when they were in Miami, they planned strategies for desegregation. They planned how they would go downtown and sit, for instance, at a counter, a lunch counter, or how they would ride and sit in the front of the bus. And one of the things that Dr. Martin Luther King stressed was nonviolence, because many people felt that, you know, to disobey the law would put you in danger with the police, and how the police would treat you if you sat at a counter. And then some people said they didn't know if they could take the violence from the police. He's teaching nonviolence, but what about the violence from the police? And should you just accept that?
What was the movement like here in South Florida? So much of the attention was in the Deep South. But what was going on here in South Florida, in Miami?
Well, it was a little different here because the white people who were in power were also concerned about the image of Miami. And they would sit down and talk with black people to try to prevent some of the things from happening that happened in other parts of the country, in other parts of the South. For instance, I'll give you an example. When black people decided that they wanted to go to the beach, because there was no place in Miami where black people could go to the beach. And when they were led by Attorney Thomas, L.E. Thomas, who took money with him to Hallover Beach, when they went to Hallover Beach to go into the water, and he just knew they were going to be arrested for violating the law. But they were not. And then he had a conference, I think it was with the sheriff and the powers that be, to get a beach for the black people, which was Virginia Key Beach.
So that's when the conversation started about having a beach, a separate beach.
A separate beach, yeah, for black people.
Dr. King crafted his I Have a Dream speech at the Hampton House, and he even practiced it for a small audience. What do we know about how that speech was received? And because, I mean, you think about it, that's where he was practicing. How has that shaped the history of the Hampton House?
You know, A.D. Moore, who I heard say this, he too is now deceased. But he said he was sitting right there next to Dr. King. And when he gave that speech, he said he just felt all kinds of thrills going up and down his spine.
Because this is the famous Dr. King speech. He's practicing it here in South Florida before he gives it to the nation.
Right, and he said that was a speech that was thunderous. It was magnificent. I could see him telling us about it because he was present when it took place. And he said that just touched everybody in the room.
And that, of course, I mean, that just builds that allure and that history for the Hampton House, because that's where it started.
That's right. That's right.
I'm talking with Dr. Enid C. Pinckney. She is the president and CEO of the historic Hampton House, legendary Miami hotel, where a number of iconic African-American athletes and civil rights leaders and other celebrities stayed during the era of segregated Miami, one of those being Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. We're reflecting on King's legacy here in South Florida and the significance of the community space. Just 2 years prior to Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination, he delivered the speech at the historic Hampton House, establishing the creation of the local chapter of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and he spoke about the need for blacks in Miami's new Cuban population to work together and not combat for their place in the job market. And here's a piece of that.
Admittedly, the social dilemma in Miami is unique in that it has both Negro and Cuban refugees flooding the job market, seeking the same menial, low-paying jobs. But it would be cruel and indeed inhuman for the power structure to pit these two ethnic groups against one another in competition for mere survival, thereby creating explosive tensions that might one day become a blight upon this lovely community.
What can you tell us about what was happening at that time, the relationship between the Cuban community and the black community? What was it like?
Well, the Cubans were coming to Miami at that time, and they were coming in large numbers. And I think that Dr. King was prophetic in that statement. It's good that that was recorded, because a lot of what he said actually came true. I feel that it's true that because the job market is so slim, and it's so hard for many, especially young black people, to get jobs. And now, when they have to know Spanish or another language, that puts another burden on them. So I feel that he was prophetic in his statement and seeing what would eventually probably happen in the community.
And after that, did things change? Did things get better?
Well, I think we're still trying to deal with that situation. I think we're
all
still,
these years later.
All these years later, I think it's still something that needs to be addressed.
It's important to note that Dr. King never led a protest down the streets of Miami. This city isn't seen as critical in the battleground in Dr. King's legacy, like Washington, D.C. or Montgomery, Alabama. But Dr. King came down here and he was still working on ideas. And obviously, as we said, he was working on his very famous speech. Was coming to Miami almost like maybe a little bit of an escape?
I think that Miami was an escape because he could relax. He could come to Miami. He could come to the Hampton House and relax. And you see, I understand what some of the things that happened, for instance, in Alabama, because I went to school. I graduated from Talladega College in Talladega, Alabama. And I was a member of the YWCA when they had a state conference in Alabama, and there was no place that we could go where white people and black people could be in the same room. And I remember we went to Dexter Avenue Baptist Church, where there was a Reverend Johns, who was the pastor of that church before Dr. Martin Luther King became the pastor. And this Reverend Johns, he like paved the way for Dr. Martin Luther King, because he worked with the people to try to have them have courage to stand up for their rights. And when Dr. Martin Luther King came on the scene as pastor of Dexter Avenue Baptist Church, the minds of the people had already been stirred up by Johns. And so, you see, I can see the difference because I know how I was treated in Alabama when I was going to college. And Miami was a little different. Miami had a little different taste in the atmosphere. It wasn't as hard as it was, let's say, in Alabama. Because I remember coming home on the train one night, and the train was late, and it was so cold in Alabama. We were in Birmingham, and they would not let us in the train station. We were on the outside. And by the time the train got to Birmingham, my feet was almost frozen. I had no feelings in it, you know? So, and they didn't care. They did not care. So, you know, I understand. So coming to Miami would be, although we did have problems too that needed to be dealt with, I don't think they were as severe as some of the other places.
When you think about Dr. King's legacy and all the things that he accomplished, why isn't more of his time in Miami talked about?
Well, maybe because they don't know. That could be one of the reasons. I'm not quite sure. I can't put a definite answer to that question, but I think that lack of knowledge as to exactly what happened and how he did help with the desegregation of Miami might not be as known, because it didn't cause as much notoriety as it did in other places. And because the whites and the blacks got together and settled so many things that he did accomplish, that it didn't get the publicity.
And that was Dr. Enid Pinckney, the president and CEO of the Hampton House. Again, the Hampton House will be celebrating Dr. King's legacy with live music and conversations between 1 and 5 o'clock today. You can read more about the historic Hampton House and Dr. King's time in Miami by going to our website, WLRN.org. And you're hearing music from the local ensemble Seraphic Fire. Their concert series, I Have a Dream, music from the African-American tradition, kicks off in Miami Beach on Wednesday with shows in Boca Raton, Coral Gables, Fort Lauderdale, and Cutler Bay to come. We'll have more details on our website. Still to come, the Sundial team heads to the Homestead Rodeo. That's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. For 70 years, Homestead has hosted a national rodeo event. It attracts young cowboys, cowgirls, and fans from all over the state and many other places. Now, last week on Sundial, we spoke with Jim Bauman, president of the Homestead Rodeo. Then on Friday, the Sundial team went to talk with some of the personalities that create the rodeo experience. As we arrived, horses were being taken off their trailers and led into a large horse pen to roam around. Now, many of the horses, bulls, and calves that are part of the event are provided by stock contractors like Dustin Murray. He told us where the animals come from.
They are bred for rodeo. Historically, back in the day when rodeo first started, they were just kind of maybe wild or the ornery horses and bulls and stuff like that. But now, in the last 20 years, breeding programs have been developed, and so we breed them. We get the best stallions, the best mares, and we breed them just like you would a racehorse or any sort of riding horse or any animal for that matter. Same with the bucking bulls. They're all bred to buck.
How long does, I guess, a career for a horse or a bull, for any of the animals, last? How long can they continue to do that?
On the horses, they can last for an incredible amount of time. So we kind of start horses at the rodeos around maybe 4 and 5 years old. And horses that have long careers, they can buck well into their early 20s. So 20, 21, 22 years old. We have a 19-year-old mare here at Homestead this weekend. That's she's actually the mother of horses that have performed at the National Finals Rodeo. So it's just they can last a long time. And the reality is they work very little, so they work about 8 to 10 times a year, and it helps keep their careers long.
Where are the horses, where are the animals for rodeos mostly bred and trained? Is that any of that take place in Florida?
Definitely. There's several horse breeders and bull breeders, especially in Florida. But really, the geographic location, it's just like racehorses. I mean, they breed and raise bucking horses and bucking bulls all over the country, from New York State to all the way to the West Coast. There's not really necessarily a hub. Maybe Texas, Oklahoma could be like more concentrated population of bucking horse and bucking bull breeders, but just like racehorses, they breed them all over the place.
What kind of horses are best for rodeo?
It's more of a crossbreed, but what we call them is a warm-blooded horse. So they're more of a bigger boned, like a bigger foot, like a draft somewhat cross. So those are the best horses. It's the ones that have the size, they're sizier. So not necessarily a quarter horse, but even along that same thread, there's really no... there's no exact recipe. So, you know, there could be little horses that are great bucking horses. We have a horse here called Peanut Butter Oreo, just went to the National Finals Rodeo, and she's like, she's a little bitty thing. She's like 14 hands tall, probably weighs 1,000 pounds. I mean, but she bucks like a big horse. And then we've got a great big horse that we call Redzilla that's probably weighs 1,500 pounds. And it's kind of like the cowboy, like it's about the heart, you know what I mean? So it's kind of the size of the heart of the animal.
Wade Ellsworth and Brian Eisenbrunn watching on closely. All right, come on, help him out. Help him out. You got it. You got it, Jamie. Don't weaken now. Don't weaken now. Attaboy, attaboy, attaboy.
That voice is Wayne Brooks. He's the 5-time Rodeo Announcer of the Year for the Professional Rodeo Cowboys Association. Now, depending on the rodeo, you might find him behind the microphone in a booth. But at the Homestead Rodeo, he spends the entire show on a horse. Brooks was once a rodeo contestant himself, and he told us why the announcer helped bring the whole show together.
It's about communicating our business, what we do, who we are, where we've been, where we're going. My job is to let people know what they're watching, what's going on, a little bit about the contestants, and take them on a little roller coaster ride. You know, it's an excitement level up here for a while, and then you kind of come down here for a little while, and different events will bring different excitement levels. And so hopefully, whether it's their first rodeo or their 51st, everybody that comes in and sits down, whether they know rodeo or not, has a great time. That's our job.
You're not always inside of like a booth or something. Sometimes you're out there with the contestants. You walk around, right? You spend time with people.
Actually, here is one of the locations throughout the year, throughout the country, where I do it on a horse. I ride a horse around the arena. So it puts a face to the voice, a face to the name, and it allows you to press the flesh, get right next to the fence and shake some hands and find out where people are from and laugh and smile and have fun. And if you do, hopefully they will.
When you look back on your career as a contestant, what do you remember most?
You know, the adrenaline rush, the excitement that comes with the events in rodeo, is across the board with all 7 events, and I remember that very well. I was never very good. Dustin Murray was very good, our stock contractor. He won a lot of great big rodeos across the country. I was never very good, but I had fun. I enjoyed it. The excitement level, the adrenaline rush, the camaraderie of the other contestants, all of those things come into play in our industry, and that's what makes it exciting.
If a person's ever been to a rodeo, what do you tell them about what to expect and how to approach this so you get the most out of it?
You can certainly kill them with too many statistics and too much information. So it's basically the basics is what I try to stick with. This is going to be a guy on a bucking horse. He's got to ride for 8 seconds. He's got to keep his free hand away. That's kind of all you need to know as a first-time rodeo fan. Same thing in the bulls. It's a guy, he's riding a bull, he's got to ride him for 8 seconds. There's some judges out there, they're going to give him some points. You know, that's the basics of the game. In the roping, there's 2 guys in this roping event. They're going to ride out and rope a steer by the horns, turn left, and the heeler's going to try to rope 2 hind legs. The basics is really, I think, especially for first-time fans, all they need to know, because the competition, the excitement of the actual competition going on in front of their eyes tells the story.
As Brooks explained, a rodeo is made up of quite a few events. It starts with the bucking horses. You've seen this. Contestants mount the horse in the bucking chutes. It's a tight space between metal bars that keeps the animal from moving around too much. Once the rider is on and the judge gives the clearance, the gate swings open and the horse takes off. It's kicking its legs back and forth. It's trying to throw the rider off, and that rider needs to hold on for at least 8 seconds. Other competitions include steer wrestling, calf roping, barrel racing, and bull riding, just to name some. And in between all of those events, some comedy, thanks to the rodeo clown.
Come on, sir. Try it again. If you're happy and you know it, clap your hands. If you're ugly and you know it, clap your hands.
Johnny Dudley on the circuit, he's known as Backflip Dudley, is a former Marine. He was drawn to the rodeo at a young age. He actually told us the story of when he knew that's what he wanted to do for a living.
It's kind of a cool story. I was in Beaufort, South Carolina. I was in the Marine Corps and I was stationed there. A rodeo came to our base and I watched a clown. He was just out there jumping around having fun, and he ran into the stands and he was messing with people and just having a good time. And I was like, that looks like a pretty fun job. I talked to him after the rodeo, and I said, man, how can I do that? And he said, well, it's pretty easy. You just got to find somewhere to practice at and find somebody that'll let you start. That's the hard part about it, is just getting your start. Shoot, back 15 years ago, I quit my job and hadn't had a job since.
How do you describe what a rodeo clown does?
Well, throughout the rodeo, my job is entertainment. I go out there, I tell the jokes, I have the fun, I talk to the crowd, mess with the crowd. During a rodeo, you know, of course, we're dealing with live animals, we're dealing with live people, so there's going to be some lulls in action. Not everything's going to go exactly how we want it all the time, so it leaves little holes in the rodeo that need to be filled with something, and why not do it with comedy? It just makes it fun to me and makes the rodeo better, I think, but that's pretty much my job. And then when the bull riding comes around, then it gets a little bit more dangerous and it gets a little bit better because that's when I get inside the barrel and I protect the bull riders and the bullfighters. Kind of give them a little island of safety if they get in a little trouble, if a bull's chasing them or something, they can come to me.
Tell me real quickly about, with the outfit that you wear, like, how did you design the outfit for you, and is it different? Do you change it? And by the way, I need to know where you got the nickname Backflip. Is it from that time you tried to backflip over a bull?
The Backflip nickname came from back when I was just starting out. Every time they introduced me, I'd do a backflip off the top row of the fence or off my barrel or something into the arena. And then I got to where I could backflip over bulls. So then it set me apart from about everybody because I was known as the guy who does the backflips. So that's where the backflip name stuck. The outfit, it's personalized, yes, but it's kind of funny to go throughout my whole outfit because whenever I started this, I didn't know what I wanted or how to do it. So first things first is you got to wear makeup. And whenever I started wearing that makeup, I didn't know how to put makeup on. But the Ultimate Warrior was my favorite wrestler when I was a kid. And so it's kind of have a little bit of Ultimate Warrior in my face paint. I used to wear a big red foam hat. And the foam hat came because there's another clown named Troy Lurwell that I really looked up to. And I wanted to be like him. And he wore a foam hat, so I wore a foam hat. My red and white striped shirt came from an old bullfighter world champion named Miles Hare. He used to wear a red and white striped shirt, and I want to be like him. The big baggy pants, that's just tradition. All clowns wear them. My shoes, I wear one red shoe, one blue shoe. And that kind of came from another clown that's a friend of mine that I look up to named Gizmo. Gizmo McCracken wears green shoe and an orange shoe. And so I wear two separate shoes just like old Gizmo. That's pretty much it. I mean, all of it has a reasoning behind it for me. And I don't know if I'm just copying all my buddies or if I'm paying tribute to them. But either way, it means something to me.
Tell me, really, what is it like when the bull comes out? Are you scared?
It's not scary anymore. There's been times that have been scary. But last year I worked 130 nights. I worked 130 different rodeo performances at 40 different rodeos throughout the nation. And so I'm doing this one out of every three nights of the year for the last 15 years. It's not scary anymore. It's a job.
Have you ever suffered an injury, from one of the bulls?
I got my foot stepped on one time, took about 26 stitches in the bottom of my foot and broke my foot. That hurt pretty bad. I was jumping over a bull one time and he hit me right in my shins and blew out both my knees. So I tore my ACL, MCL, and meniscus in both knees at the same time. One time I was in Lubbock, Texas. A bull named Friendly Frank hooked me, threw me up in the air. When I came down, he stepped on my hand. So I got 10 screws and two plates in my hand, shattered it. The next night, I had surgery that night. The next night at the rodeo, the same bull came out, and I had a cast on my arm. He threw me up in the air again, but I couldn't put my hand down to land, so I landed on the cast, and I broke all my ribs on my right side. Salt Lake City, Utah, 2007. Bull got me, and I was trying to do a backflip over him, which really wasn't a good idea, and broke my neck. Other than that, I really hadn't been hurt too bad.
As you heard, only a couple of injuries here and there. And if you were wondering what that wailing sound was during our conversation with Backflip Dudley, well, that was his six-month-old white miniature poodle named Rowdy, who was actually part of the act. Now, before he had Rowdy, Johnny used a skunk in his act. Yes, an actual skunk. Now, lastly, we talked to the rodeo queen. The queen can be seen riding around the rodeo arena in between events. Each year, the Homestead Rodeo crowns a new queen, and this year, it was 19-year-old Felicity Akers. We talked to her about what it means to wear the crown.
How long have you been involved in this?
I've been coming to the Homestead Rodeo since I was 5, which is really crazy. I'm 19 now. I've been involved with Posse, I think, for about 5 years. I've worked their corn booth, and this year I'm actually a full member, and I'm riding with them this year.
All right, so tell us, what is Posse?
Posse is a mounted drill team where we do this really cool drill in the middle of the arena during the rodeo, and it's just a really cool experience.
Going back to the first time you went to a rodeo, what was the allure? What was the appeal for you? What did you enjoy most about it? Take me back, if you remember that, what it was like.
Well, I remember getting a little blue hat, and I got this little rope. I was pretending I was a roper, but I definitely wasn't. Couldn't get it over my head, but I was doing the little spin. It was really cute. And I just remember being so wide-eyed and, like, at awe at, like, these people on these horses and, like, wow, can I do that? And as I'm sitting here today, I'm like, yeah, I can. It's really cool.
How do you become rodeo queen? What's the process?
Well, you go out and you sell advanced sale tickets to the rodeo, and you can do different fundraisers to raise more money. It's basically how much money you bring in at the end.
Tell me a little bit about the outfit, because it's one of the things I find fascinating is, well, just, you know, the hats and the boots and everything else, but with you especially, a little bit more. Tell me about your outfit.
So we have a button-down shirt. Sometimes it has pockets, sometimes it doesn't. And they're really, like, blingy and stylish. And your jeans always have to be blingy, and your belts as well. And you always have, like, this really cool belt buckle. This year we actually got a queen buckle. The queen and princess get their own buckle. And then we have our hat, and then we put a crown on. It's not your traditional, like, tiara kind of crown. It actually says Homestead Rodeo Queen on it.
The rodeo was a 3-day event. You can check out pictures and video on our Facebook under the photo album called Homestead Rodeo 2019, or on Twitter at WLRN Sundial, or on the WLRN Instagram account. Well, still to come, we're going to look at a new television series only available on Facebook. It's about a family in Hialeah, filmed in Hialeah. That's coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. In 1977, a television show produced in Miami hit the airwaves with a novel new idea. It was bilingual, the first ever bilingual television show in U.S. history, and the first sitcom produced by PBS. Que Pasa USA was a show about a Cuban family, the Peñas. They were a multi-generational family getting accustomed to life in a new country. They lived in the Little Havana community.
I want to be a gardener.
You are doing fine. With a little luck, they might be able to get a job at Parrot Jungle.
Now, 40 plus years later, there's another group following in those footsteps and also trying to break new ground. It's a show called Hialeah, and it's available only on Facebook. It's the story of a couple, Kay and Mariposa, who have eloped and are now in Hialeah to meet her family. Mariposa is a Cuban American and Kay is a Jew from the Midwest, and the comedy ensues as they try to figure out how to explain the relationship to the family. Now, the first season is a half dozen episodes. It's the creation of Melissa Carcache, David Vargas, and Javier Mayol. Melissa also plays Mariposa, and Jordan Wall plays her husband, Kay. Jordan and David joined us from the studios of KPCC in Pasadena. Melissa was here in Miami, and we started with her. She told us where the idea came from.
I was moving back to Miami, actually, from L.A., and I really wanted to tell a story about my family inspired by Que Pase USA, but I didn't want to make Que Pase USA. I wanted to do the perspective of now, the refugee/immigrant's child's perspective, like the ones that were born in America. And it was just such a magical moment because when I met with David, he also wanted to do a show just like this. And his partner, Javier, wanted to do a show just like this. So I was like, there's no better time to do this than right now. And really, we want to tell the story of our family.
So, Melissa, you have this idea. You're moving back to Miami from L.A. David, you guys both knew each other since middle school.
So, yeah.
But you, David, were leaving Miami to go to L.A., and then you guys find each other after many years. And how did this conversation start? And when did this idea really start to germinate?
For me personally, the night that Fidel Castro passed away, I was at my mom's house having a bit of a case of insomnia that night. And I just remember hearing this moment spoken about since I was a kid from the perspective of my parents, my grandparents, you know, if the conversation ever aroused, well, will you ever go back to Cuba? And the response was, yo regreso a Cuba el día que Fidel se cae. And that was always the coin phrase that I think resonated not only with my family, but with so many other Cuban families. And that night when that happened, it just seemed like such a visceral moment, and I really didn't know what to do, but I felt like there was something that I needed to do. So I took off to 49th Street, just started filming all sorts of reactions, and I've never seen so much celebration and sadness all in one spot. I really felt like there was something that more story that needed to be told, in other words, because it's just, I feel there's such an underrepresented presence for stories that relate to the Latin community, or just, you know, stories that aren't specifically American.
So let's get into the story a little bit. So here you have this couple, Kay and Mariposa, and they secretly get married in Las Vegas. Lots of people do that, but here's the thing. It's like she is part of a Cuban-American family, and anybody that knows a Latino family, that you don't do. the couple come to Hialeah to meet the parents, and it's just anxiety. So let's hear that scene.
Dios mío, ¿quién es este tipo?
Cálmate, mima, este es Kay. Mi novio, este es mi novio.
¿Eh?
¿Usted no sabía que yo tenía novio?
¿Este es tu novio?
No, mima, es el cura. Claro que es mi novio.
¿Y tú?
Hola, yo me llamo Kay.
¿Qué?
Kay.
¿Qué? Kay.
Kay.
¿Qué?
Hey.
¿Qué? Pero este niño es bobo o algo.
¿Cómo que se llama este muchacho?
Así como se llama, Kay, y él no habla español.
¡Un gringo!
Oye, Mari, este no sirve, búscate otro, mija.
Oh, you are making a hell of a first impression.
You will all listen to me or we will leave for good. All my life, you guys have lived under the stupid delusion that I was going to stay here in Miami.
No, para ahí. Delusion que... Oye, speak Spanish, que no te entiendo.
Está bien, abuelo.
Jordan, I want to start with you. You play the outsider. You are this Jewish man from the Midwest. You've never set foot in Hialeah. You don't speak a lick of Spanish. So how do you describe this series to people who've never seen it?
It's very much a meet the parents crossover with anything on telenovela. it's a fish out of water story, you know, which I think anybody can relate to. Quirky comedy with a lot of heart. That's what drew me to it.
You are this character. You really are this character.
Certainly, I can relate to a lot of the little quirks and intricacies in the character, the neuroses, the vulnerability, the heart that Kay has, you know, that stuff is, you know, I kind of wear it on the surface, and a lot of the instincts kind of just popped right out for me as soon as I read the script. I really understood the character that David and Javier wrote. it wasn't a stretch. Yeah, it's it was not a stretch.
And you know what? I mean, Jordan, first of all, I mean, had you ever been to Hialeah, and do you speak Spanish?
Un poquito? No, that's being kind. I don't speak any Spanish, very little, which is kind of sad because I'm from Florida, and I spent 4 years working in South Florida. I went to Hialeah once, but I didn't even see in the daytime. I was only there at night, so I really got to see it, truly, literally, got to see it in the day for the first time with David and Melissa and the whole entire crew and cast. And yeah, I got exposed to a lot of real authentic Cuban culture.
Melissa, this really stays authentic to that kind of experience, the Latino experience in the family. But take us into that house.
Into that house and really all of our homes, it's very chaotic. There's always a lot of cooking going on, which is happening in this scene. There's always some sort of sports being played, or even the news is being played, which happens as well. But it's a very, for someone who has never been around this sort of environment, it can be extremely intimidating and scary and overwhelming, because as soon as somebody walks through the house, they're feeding you, they're hugging you, they're kissing you, they want to know everything about you. And especially for a girl in the family, like, I know what this is like. When you bring a boy home, oh boy, that's like interrogating. You want to know everything about him. You want to know his blood type. You want to know his social. Like, you want to know everything. So it's a big deal. And for Jordan's character, it's, and he does it so well, it's very overwhelming. Like, it's scary.
I'm talking with Melissa Carcache and David Vargas and Jordan Wall. Melissa and David are the co-creators of a show called Hialeah. It's a series on Facebook and YouTube. Jordan is one of the stars of the show, along with Melissa. They actually played a married couple who are meeting the parents for the first time. And it's a show that's filmed here in Hialeah. And the actors are truly Cuban-American, playing Cuban-Americans. Again, you can catch the show on Facebook or on YouTube. Also find out more at our website, WLRN.org. David, you know, Jordan didn't know a lot about, I mean, you know, they were saying things, he didn't know what they were saying, but that added to the anxiety.
We were so fortunate to find characters who were professional and classically trained actors, but they didn't have to do too much or stretch too much to fall into what their characters were about. Meaning everybody in our cast are authentic Cuban, and Jordan is authentically an American Jewish guy, which I mean we didn't have to play too much pretend. We just had to really pretend to be everybody's family, and I think that's what resonated so much with our audience, because anybody can watch this show and, you know, not just say, hey, that's his family or that's her family. Everybody who watches this show says, this is my family, that's my grandmother, I know somebody who married a guy like this or married a girl like this and brought them into the family and had a hard time with the acceptance right out of the gate. And Jordan oftentimes admitted to me between takes, dude, I don't know what's going on here, man. I mean, I don't know what they're saying. I don't get it. And I would just shrug his shoulders and say, you're doing great, man. You're going to win an Oscar.
And Jordan,
and it shines through the lens.
Jordan, how do you, as a performer, how do you use that?
Well, they say being lost sometimes is the best place to be as an actor, and so that took on a whole new meaning to me during this shoot. But I think that paid off. I think actually being lost was the best thing, because I was genuinely responding to what I was not understanding. But I did get a lot of intention behind all the actors, because it really felt like I was walking into a true family, a family that had grown up and lived together. It was amazing how comfortable all these actors were, some whom didn't even know each other. And they really were just living in this world that had existed for so long. And I think it's because they're all authentic Cuban.
From a directing standpoint, it was not, I didn't really need to hone in with everybody's performance and tell them to focus on certain Cuban idiosyncrasies that they needed to incorporate into their performance, because they already knew what they were. They would read a line and say, you know, I know how I need to say this line. I know the inflection. I know what you mean here. And so that was it made my job very easy. The fact that everybody knew how, not only how to read the line, but how to perform the line. And I think that's what really made this so authentic.
You know, something interesting, two things I want to get to here. One, this series plays on Facebook. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've talked to groups here in South Florida that have filmed here in South Florida, and they found online platforms to get their show out, not the traditional networks or even Hulu or Netflix. But why Facebook? And do you think this is where the future is? Melissa, you have an interesting take on this. You really wanted Facebook.
Yeah, I really wanted Facebook. I mean, our demographic is already there, so just that made a lot of sense for us, you know. But I'm a big internet fan in producing content, and really content's been produced online for some time now. I would say really started popping in 2010, and that's where the future is and where I feel it's gonna be. The freedom that we have, like for me, I don't feel like this show in the hands of a traditional network would do well because it won't be 100% authentic.
And David, I mean, you know, because it goes to the question of where does this go from here? She also talked about that authenticity. Are you worried that if you find a network, a distributor, that they would probably try to change it? Because, and the authenticity is the fact that you have all these Cuban Americans played by Cuban Americans. So, but I don't know, what's your take on that?
Well, I think the great thing about Facebook is that it allows you to already show a fan base that we've already been able to garner. You know, you can look into our episodes and you can see the comments, you can see the reactions. And a lot of what you'll see is people saying, hey, this is me. This speaks to me. This is my family. This is somebody's family that I know. So we can use that as kind of putting the proof in the pudding as to telling a network, if somebody approaches us saying, look, we're doing something right, we have an audience already, you know, look at the complete puzzle and let's see how we can move forward without losing what we've already created.
But what is the next step? What are you trying to, season one done, it's in the can, now what do you do, David?
The conception of this project has been totally organic from the very beginning. So what we need our audience to do is just to go in there and share as much as possible and really make a dent in the social media world so that we can start turning heads. As soon as we can do that and start getting some more attention, I think it's going to naturally lead us into the next step, like we've been naturally guided through this entire process.
And you heard from David Vargas. We also heard from Melissa Carcace and Jordan Wall. David and Melissa are the co-creators of the Facebook comedy sitcom Hialeah. Jordan is one of the stars of the show. You can find out more on our Facebook page, WLRN Sundial. And that's Sundial for this Monday, January 21st, this MLK Day. I'm Luis Hernandez. Once again, you can always find us on Facebook or Twitter, WLRN Sundial, or go to WLRN.org. Thanks so much for listening. We'll be back again tomorrow.